Welcome to our May series of seminars, Four Women You Should Never Forget. We are absolutely delighted to welcome back Dr. Jack Opperle to lead us in the stories of these four remarkable women. But more important than that, he's actually back living in Pittsburgh. So we are so happy to have him and his wife, Barbara, with us today in Galbreath Chapel, and we just want to welcome them back to the neighborhood. Today's topic is Harriet Tubman, the conductor. And now Jack will open with prayer.
Let us pray. God, for the goodness of our lives, we give you our thanks. For the wonder of the world, we give you our thanks. For the abuse of power, and for those who suffer, and for the difficult questions of our age, we pray for your guidance. Bless us in this time, and may it be for us a blessing. Through Christ our Lord, amen. Well, it is good to be back. As some of you may know, we moved east.
We need your mic, Jack.
Okay. I have a green light.
You do?
I do, yeah.
Where's the microphone itself?
Right here.
Oof. It's not making any sound, I don't think.
I hear it fine.
Okay.
Am I okay? I mean, is the mic okay?
It's my bad.
It's totally my bad.
All right. We moved down east about a year and a half ago, and it was a nice place and we enjoyed it, da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da. But the fundamental truth was we simply missed the burg. You don't move away from a place, you move away from people. And for us, it was just not something that we could sustain. And as a result of that, we decided to move back. That was complicated by a little problem I had in August when I suffered a very mild, but nevertheless, kind of wake-up call. I had a little bit of a stroke, and the only real issue that I've had as a result of that is I got some issues with my legs, but other than that, I'm doing okay. And fortunately for me, it did not affect my speech. So, and that's where I live. So, legs, they can come and go with good stools. I've been noticing that many of the books that one finds in a library, particularly church libraries, usually are entitled Great Men of the Faith. And I think that's obvious because Christianity is a faith that was begun and to some degree directed and shaped and molded by men. The tragedy is that over the years, not much has changed. In the generations that we now have as leadership, we are beginning to see some nuances where that's beginning to change. But we have forgotten the enormous heritage that women have provided in the faith community. And so I began to think about and read about some of the people that I knew about just by in a very casual kind of way, and wondering what kind of impact did they have upon the age in which we live. And so I've identified four women. This morning we're going to look at Harriet Tubman, an abolitionist. More critically than that, somebody who did something about it. Next week, we're going to look at Corrie Ten Boom, the woman who aided thousands of Jews to escape to Norway in the face of Nazism. Then we're going to look at Rosa Parks, a woman of faith who said, I'm sorry, I'm going to sit right here. You do what you have to do. And then lastly, we're going to look at Mother Teresa, who, after winning the Nobel Peace Prize, which, as you all know, is accompanied by a significant purse, stipend, it was expected she was just going to hand that over to the Vatican. And Mother Teresa said, absolutely not. There are poor people in Calcutta that need a place to live, and we're going to build a high-rise for them. Obviously, each one of those women, I think, has made a significant contribution to the development of the faith. And more critically than that, each one of them did something that laid a foundation for moving forward. And so this morning we look at Harriet Tubman, the conductor, the woman who is responsible for thousands of slaves finding their way north to freedom, first in Philadelphia, ultimately on into Ontario. Her story is unique, and therefore I think it deserves to be told with some degree of specificity. She was born in March of 1822, but even that's up for grabs because historians tell us they're not real sure when she was born. They are sure she was, in fact, born. She was born Arminta Ross. That was her given Christian name. Who were her parents? They were slaves. Her mother, Harriet, also known as Rit, is believed to have been a child of a marriage, or at least a sexual relationship between her mother and a white owner. Think about that for a minute. Her dad, Ben Gross, was a man who had enormous abilities with wood and worked as a slave in the timber industry of his owner. They married in 1808. They had 9 children. And Harriet, also known as Arminta, was the middle child. Maybe that tells the story. She was the middle child, conceived in slavery, and she lived with that burden. Probably because her mother... Is that me? No? Okay. Because of her mother probably having been light-skinned, probably having been a mulatto child, she was taken up to the big house. If you know anything about slavery, you know that the fundamental concept of slavery and consequently racism is the whole issue of blackness. That's the problem. If an African-American could just be white, a lot of their difficulties would go away. Same way in this period in the 19th century. If you were a light-skinned black, you probably didn't work in the field. You weren't charged to be in the quarter taking care of the animals. You were invited to the big house because for some reason, the lightness of your skin suggested acceptability. Now, there was an upside to that. It was good work. It was relatively easy work. You weren't subject to the abuses of the field hands. Here's the downside. Precisely because Rit, Harriet, mother to these 9 children, was at the big house, guess what? There was nobody at the slave quarter to take care of them. And so as early as the age of 6, by her own recording, Arminta, known soon to be as Harriet, was charged with taking care of her siblings. Think about that. At the age of 6, she is caring for 8 siblings. She did it so well that the owner, a man by the name of Broadus, realized she was a cash cow. And so he began to hire her out to take care of other families' children. As early as the age of 8, Harriet Tubman was hired out, subcontracted to other slave owners to take care of their children. Ah, but listen to this. As a child taking care of children, she was subjected to treatment that it was unbelievably harsh. If a child cried when the owner felt the child should not cry, Harriet was whipped. And until she died in 1913, she carried on her body the scars endured as a child because the child that she was caring for cried out. And her punishment for that was to be whipped. Think about this too. As a little child, 8 years old, she learned how to protect herself against that. And this is what she would do. She wore layers of clothing on her body so that when the lash hit her, there was some degree of insulation that would protect her from harm. I tell you that story to suggest to you how it was that this child became an adult at the age of a child, and that she endured enormous difficulties. Now, as a child, she suffered a very serious head injury. One afternoon, one of the male slaves had done something that was incorrect, and the owner picked up some sort of a metal weight and threw it at the male slave, hoping to hurt him. Obviously, the man's aim wasn't so good, and instead of hitting the male slave, he hit this little girl, Arminta, known to be Harriet, in the head. She suffered a fractured skull. There was brain damage done to this child, and it produced what today we call frontal lobe epilepsy. There were no convulsions, no seizures involved in that particular issue, but it did affect her ability to think sometimes. And the ability to think meant that she confused various kinds of experiences. She began to have visions that she believed were of God, when in fact they were probably caused by the dysfunction of her brain. She also began to hear things that probably was the result of damage to the brain that affected the auditory nerves. She thought it was God. Was she handicapped? Not at all. Because as I'll say down the road, after a while, the belief that she was hearing from God, the fact that when she looked at a slave, she saw God's purpose in terms of saying, set that person free. And so as a result of her brain injury, Harriet Tubman became a woman of faith, a woman of faith, and a woman of freedom. Her mother, Rit, told her child Bible stories. That was the way in which African Americans of that era communicated the Bible. They probably didn't have a Bible for openers, and if they did, they probably couldn't read it. And so mother read Bible stories to her daughter. Oh, and here's something else that really speaks to me. They were members and belonged to and attended regularly the Methodist Church. How about that, huh? They were taken by their mother to be a part of the Methodist tradition. Now, of course, you must remember that the Methodist tradition to which that family went was the AME tradition begun by Richard Allen, which was a church that was segregated. Only Black people went to that. And when they went to that church, guess what? They were also supervised by their white owners. But nevertheless, every now and then, men like Richard Allen would sneak in a little bit of freedom talk. And Harriet Tubman learned that lesson early. That's her childhood. And I think you get the picture of how it could have, and did in fact, shape her, molded her, both from the point of view of sadness and tragedy and difficulty, but also from the possibility of hearing God's message for the age in which she lived. In 1844, she married a man whose name was John Tubman. John Tubman was a freedman. That meant he had either purchased or in some way earned his freedom. It was not a great marriage. Why? Pretty simple. John Tubman was a man best described by the word wuss. He played the game in order to protect himself from the harshness of the system in which he found himself, even though he was freed. His inability to be really a strong partner for her is indicated by the fact that when they were married, he promised Rit, Harriet's mother, that he would secure Harriet's freedom. That never happened. It just evaporated. And as a result, John Tubman, a freed man, lived with his wife, a slave woman, and never did anything about it. And there is some evidence that Harriet resented that, because it was during the first years of her marriage that she changed her name from Arminta, also known as Minty, to Harriet. Her biographer, Margaret Larson, suggests that there may be three reasons for that. Number one, she wanted to honor her mother, who had been such an important part of her life. Number two, she may have had some sort of a converting, enlightening experience. Or number three, perhaps she was already beginning to think about her mission, and therefore she was looking for ways to hide her identity. Regardless, Arminta became Harriet. Harriet Tubman. As she was married to John Tubman, she began to realize that her future was in jeopardy every day. And that jeopardy came into real focus whenever the owner decided that he would sell Harriet because she had contracted measles and had become extraordinarily ill, and had been nursed back to health by her mother, but nevertheless was still affected and weakened by her illness. Harriet was so kind of angered and distraught by the possibility of being sold that she decided to run away. She convinced two of her brothers, Ben and Henry, to run with her. And so in 1849, off they went into the night of the winter, following the North Star, hoping to find the stations of the Underground Railroad. She did a pretty good job, excepting for her two brothers. They learned that there had been a reward posted by the owner. And if you know anything about that period of time, you know that in 1850, there was something called the Slave Redemption Act that was passed. And it made it very lucrative for the slave owners to hire men to go out and find the runaways. Two brothers panicked. They decided they wanted to go back to the safety of the slave quarter. And so they went and they took their sister with them. Less than 2 months later, Harriet Tubman decided she was going to run away again. Only this time, she left her brothers at home. And there's an interesting, interesting lore that's accompanying that second choice. When she was finally got back to where her brothers wanted to be, she learned that indeed her owner was prepared to sell her. For now, you'll see, she was also a disobedient slave. She began to pray to God that God would change the owner's mind. After a while, that began to be obvious that it wasn't going to happen. And so her prayer was kicked up a notch. And this time she began to pray that God would take her owner in death. The interesting part about that is, the guy died. And that only enhanced the fact that indeed Harriet Tubman was on a mission from God. Her first journey back into the eastern shore of Maryland had to do with her niece and her niece's children. They had been owned by the man who owned her, only it had been decided that they would be sold. And they were actually taken to, to a slave market where they were put on display for purposes of sale. Fortunately, the niece's husband was a freed man. And he went to that auction that day and for $500 bought the freedom of his wife and his two children. He then slipped off with his new purchase and he met up with Harriet, who had arranged to meet them in Baltimore, Maryland. She arranged for this husband and wife and their two children to find their way to Philadelphia and ultimately to Ontario, Canada. That was her first experience of utilizing the Underground Railroad to free slaves from the harshness of their existence. That trip was to be followed by many. She went back, for example, and she rescued the two brothers who had talked her into going back. Beyond that, she rescued their wives and their children and brought them out. And finally, one of her last trips was to deal with her aging parents. Finally, her dad had been able to pay for his wife's freedom. She was old and she was frail and she was weak, and the owner didn't have any need for her anymore. And thus for $20, think about that, $20, he bought his wife in freedom. They continued to live on the eastern shore of Maryland, and they continued to be a part of the Underground Railroad system. And after a while, it just got too dangerous for these two old people to be involved in that kind of a risk game. And so Harriet Tubman, missing her mom and dad so desperately, arranged to go back to the eastern shore of Maryland, where she found her mom and her dad and brought them out. They ultimately spent the remainder of their years living with her in a house in Auburn, New York. And we'll talk more about that later. But just know that Harriet never forgot those Bible stories. She never forgot that mom who cared for her. She never forgot that dad who worked so difficult. And here's something else. She never forgot her maternal grandmother. Her maternal grandmother's name was Modesty. Modesty. As best we know, Modesty came to America on one of those infamous slave ships. And if you don't know about that, you need to read the book Before the Mayflower. And read how it was that slaves were captured in Africa. And they were beaten and they were subdued while in Africa to break their spirit. And then they were put on slave ships. And in those slave ships, in the cargo areas, there were levels built. Shelves on which human beings were chained. And thus they would lay on their back for the duration of that journey. It was called the long voyage, when they would lose all sense of time and light and direction. And of course, if you were chained on that bottom shelf, your lifespan was not very long. Modesty came by way of that experience to the New World. But what we know about Modesty is this. We think that she was a member of a tribe in Africa that had enormous and significant implications. Number one, she came from a tribe in which the women were the owners of property. She came from a tribe where identity was passed generation to generation by way of women. She came from a culture where the women were the strength and the vitality of the culture. She came from a tribe that had a very complete and somewhat complicated theology, that they worshiped a god. And the worship of that god meant it affected how they treated each other. Harriet Tubman never forgot her grandma, Modesty, who obviously gave to her womanhood a sense of purpose, dignity, and also power. One of her post last trips had to do with going back to find her sister Rachel and Rachel's children. Whenever she got back into the eastern shore of Maryland, she discovered that Rachel had died. And she also discovered that the two children that she went back to rescue had been sold into slavery. She had no money. She had nothing to trade. And as a result, she had to leave those two children behind. She later told Frederick Douglass, one of her colleagues in life, that it was the hardest, most difficult decision she had ever made. But Harriet Tubman was also a woman of thrift. She once bragged about the fact that no trip was ever wasted. And as a result, being frustrated by bringing home her Rachel and those two kids, she put together a group of other slaves and brought them on to freedom. When asked about that, this was a quote from Harriet Tubman. "I was a conductor on the Underground Railroad for nearly 8 years. Never did one of my trains go off of the track. And I never lost a passenger. Can somebody tell me, given that very, very brief discussion of this woman's background and life, why we have had so much difficulty identifying her as a woman of faith?" Let's take a look at some of the other dimensions, because Harriet Tubman's work on the Underground Railroad propelled her into a national awareness. A man by the name of John Brown, some of you may know about him. He had a rendezvous, I think, at a place called Harper's Ferry, if I'm not mistaken. And John Brown was a radical. He was a man given to and supportive of violence. He had the notion that somehow violence was the way by and through which to end slavery and bring abolition into the society. He sought out Harriet Tubman. He referred to her as General Tubman. That was the regard that this hardened, difficult man placed on this woman. She was involved with him in terms of raising funds and offering direction, making him aware of the systems that were potentially available to him as an abolitionist. However, she did not support his understanding of violence. She did not see it as a way, as a technique that should be readily used. She understood that every now and then it was the only option. But for her, it was not the first option. And as a result, on the day that John Brown led his infamous raid on Harper's Ferry, Harriet Tubman was not present. Some say she was not present because she was recuperating from an illness. Others say that she was not present because she and Frederick Douglass had learned that John Brown's plan had been revealed to the government and that federal troops were waiting for him, that he was going to fail. And they were right. Beyond that, historians have suggested that for her, that was not the answer. She also became friends with a man whose name was William Seward. He was a senator, a strong abolitionist from New York. In fact, he was one of the possible candidates that ran against Abraham Lincoln when Lincoln was nominated to be the president of the United States. William Seward was a player. William Seward was also a man of prayer. But what is important to know about William Seward is that he made his prayers happen. He did something with his prayers. And he saw to it, along with his wife, Frances, that 7 acres in Auburn, New York, could be sold to Harriet Tubman for the purposes of establishing a residency. And so that became a place where Harriet Tubman spent the last years of her life. It's a place where her mom and dad lived with her until they passed. It was a place where runaway slaves were always welcomed. And here's the best part about the house and the 7 acres in Auburn, New York. Harriet Tubman decided it was time to build a facility to accommodate poor, hopeless slaves. And so she kind of worked with the AME Church in Auburn, New York, to facilitate that dream. And they built it. She donated appropriate amounts of acreage of her 7 acres to build this nice building where people could go in their destitution. However, there was a conflict. The AME Church decided they were going to charge an entrance fee. And so they said that if you wanted to be admitted into this facility, you'd have to come up with $100. Yeah. And in that culture, that was a pretty steep number. Harriet Tubman took great exception to that. First of all, because she had given them the land on which the damn thing was built, and nobody had ever consulted her about an entrance fee. And beyond that, she said, it is wrong. And so she introduced a law that said that anybody who had money could not be admitted into the facility, and that those who would be most welcome were those who had absolutely nothing. Harriet Tubman in Auburn, New York, became a kind of folk hero. But it was more than just a folk hero. She cared about and implemented that concern for people less fortunate than she. Oh, and let me tell you about her work in the Civil War. Harriet Tubman had some interesting things to say about Abraham Lincoln. You know, Lincoln wasn't always a strong advocate of abolition. In fact, there was a time when he really did sponsor the American Colonization Society, whose solution to the problem was to gather up all the African Americans and send them back to Africa. Think about that for a minute. Generations who had been in this country, who spoke no language, knew no culture of their homeland, being gathered up and sent back. Obviously, thanks be to God, Lincoln had a revelation and changed his mind. But Harriet Tubman very much challenged his thinking. And after the war began, and after Lincoln began to show his complete dedication to the eradication of slavery, Harriet Tubman actually went to work for the Union Army. She first worked as a cook, providing meals for the soldiers. Then she became a nurse. She knew how to make plant medications, and she made those to ease the pain of the men who had been wounded. She treated their dysentery. She was involved with their day-to-day function. And after a while, Harriet Tubman became such an integral part of the Union forces that she actually became a spy. Why not? She knew all the secret places. Her knowledge of the Underground Railroad was absolutely impeccable. And beyond that, she heard a voice. And that voice said, go. And so she was a spy for several years. And after a while, they decided she ought to be a scout, that she ought to be linked to some of their regiments. And actually, Harriet Tubman became the first woman armed with a weapon to be a part of a campaign against a military installation in South Carolina from which over 700 slaves were emancipated. Harriet Tubman was a woman of many talents, including she knew how to use a revolver. And we'll say a little bit more about that in just a moment. After the war, her life pretty much retired to Auburn, New York, and she took in people who were having a hard time. One of those people was a man whose name was Nelson Davis. Nelson Davis had fought in the Civil War. And when the war ended, he had nothing. He heard about Auburn, New York, and so he journeyed there and he took a job as a bricklayer. He did some work for Harriet Tubman, and even though he was 20 years younger than she, they married. They then adopted a little baby girl, and her name was Gertie. And as is somewhat fitting, Harriet Tubman, though 22 years older than her spouse, outlived him. He died of tuberculosis in 1888. However, her marriage to that man put her back in contact with the federal government. Because, you see, as a retired, if you will, member of the armed services, Mr. Davis was entitled to certain kinds of benefits. And beyond that, so was his spouse. And even beyond that, his spouse began to say, wait a minute, I did more than marry one of your soldiers. I took care of your wounded. I cooked their meals. I led a charge down in the deep south and freed over 700 slaves. I have been a spy for your forces. Don't you think you owe me something? You believe it took until the 20th century, until the federal government finally decided to give Harriet Tubman's now foundation a little bit of money. She was never really paid, compensated for what she had done during the Civil War. By 1911, Harriet Tubman was old and frail. She was also experiencing more and more pain and difficulty in her head. And so she sought out a neurosurgeon in Boston, Massachusetts. And she wondered if he could, in fact, do something to help her live a more comfortable life. He thought he could. It would involve opening her skull and removing certain diseased areas of her brain. Ready for this one? Harriet Tubman agreed to that, but she rejected the use of any anesthetic. And so she remembered what she had seen in the Civil War. Many a limb was amputated as the victim bit down on a bullet just to do something to relieve the pain. She had the procedure, and as one might expect, she bit the bullet, and she survived. She survived until the year 1913, when she contracted pneumonia, and she died in the beloved home that she had helped to build, and she qualified for admission, because when Harriet Tubman died, she was destitute, penniless. She was and had become everything the people she had saved were running away from. To the government's credit, she is buried in the Fort Hill Cemetery in Auburn, New York. And on the day of her interment, full military honors were bestowed upon her. I'm not going to go into what's happened to Harriet Tubman's legacy, because I'm sure many of you know about that, or perhaps even have visited some of those sites. But finally, we have realized what a hero, what a heroine Harriet Tubman was. I better watch my time. What time is it? Oh, okay. What time do you want to quit, Ted? Okay, well, let me just go do a couple of things and then we'll jump into some questions. How's that sound? Okay. Or if you like, we could stay till about 3:30. Maybe somebody could go out and get some chicken or something. Let me now put into context Harriet Tubman in relationship to faith. Because you remember where I started. She was a woman of faith. And her faith, I believe, is a composite of many different influences. For example, I got to believe that her grandma, Modesty, taught her something about faith. You know, back in the day, there was a concept among Anglicanism that was known as slave Christianity. And that was a point of view that said, you know something? God wants you to be a slave. God's ordained you to be a slave. And on top of that, God has ordained this white owner to take care of you. That was a message that the Christian faith portrayed. I wonder how that settled with Modesty. Probably not very well, because she had come from a culture where dignity mattered. She had come from a culture where religion was vital. We tend to think of African Americans being brought to this country as being pagans, and that is not true. They were just different in their religious traditions. And every now and then, as I read about those differences, I've come to believe not only were they different from us, they were better than we were. So Grandma undoubtedly taught her, go down Moses. And undoubtedly, Harriet Tubman learned that song, and we know that every now and then she changed the lyrics in order to send the message of safety or danger to the slaves who were part of the railroad. She used the Black spiritual as a vehicle to communicate on a code basis with other people in flight. Number two, undoubtedly, Harriet Tubman was exposed to the kind of religion that was practiced and offered on the plantations. Owners prided themselves in providing church for their slaves. Now, it was very carefully supervised, and it was very, very directed toward the benefit of the slave owner, but it was nevertheless church. This is what Harriet Tubman once said about her owner, a man by the name of Anthony Thompson. She said, "The Mr. Thompson offers us something that plays church. It plays church." I mean, there were songs and there were preachers and there was Bible, but it was all very much skewed toward the slave owner's position. Undoubtedly, Harriet Tubman was exposed to that. Here's a third resource, I believe. I think she was exposed to something that Mr. Gates talks about in terms of the invisible church. The invisible church had nothing to do with buildings. It had nothing to do with budgets. It didn't even have much to do with structure. But there were two ingredients in the invisible church that were undeniably powerful. The first one was the Black preacher. The Black preacher knew the stories of the Bible, and he knew how to apply those stories. So as this little girl was taken to church, what did she hear? She heard about the Exodus and about God saying to Moses, "Moses, you go down there and free those people." She heard about the Isaiah stories of the Babylonian captivity and how it was that God was about freedom. And here's the second ingredient she encountered. She encountered what we call today the Negro spiritual. And by the way, that's a proper term, because that's what it is. It grew up out of the age when people of color were known as Negroes, and they're proud of that tradition. And that music became their lifeblood. And it also became the code system by and through which they often communicated each to the other. Harriet Tubman undoubtedly was exposed to the invisible church. Oh, and she also probably attended camp meetings. Camp meetings were exactly what they say they are. They were not in the woods, out from underneath the supervision of the white owner. And there, people like Sojourner Truth came and spoke. And what were their themes? Independence, freedom, dignity, self-determination. Now, if you put all those ingredients into some sort of a figurative pot, and if you stir it real well, and if you use the spoon of Harriet Tubman's brain injury and the implications that had for her in terms of hearing voices, sensing a mission of life, believing that God would protect her, I think you begin to have some understanding of how it was that this woman was so vitally effective. She is one of ours. And maybe we should say, we are one of hers. And the reason I say that is this. Ironically, Harriet Tubman is honored by many of the men who have been in the forefront of the civil rights movement in our time. Martin Luther King once called her a saint. Stokely Carmichael, the radical, who coined the phrase Black Power, understood what that really meant. It didn't mean violence. It meant freedom. James Cone, we recently lost James Cone, a wonderful theologian, taught at Union for years, an African-American by ethnicity, but a man of the world by way of his training and his experience, also named Harriet Tubman as the authoress of what it means to be a Christian. And what he meant by that is this. She is, and I quote, she is a prototype. A prototype of what every African American, indeed, what all people should do and be in the face of oppression. And that is to understand that freedom for all people is God's mission, and that the activity of God in our cultures is best described by providing for those in captivity freedom. Harriet Tubman, the conductor, a woman of faith, someone we need to very much honor and remember. I think I better stop there. And maybe we'll get some questions or comments or additions to anything that we have. Question? Nope.
So I have a question. How can we process the idea that she died penniless? What was the trajectory that led to that outcome?
A couple of things. Good. Thanks, Ted, for that. Number one, obviously, the potential sources for her getting any kind of resources never came through. I think, and if some of you are knowledgeable about this, I'd appreciate being corrected. My notion is that the best that the government ever offered her while she was alive was a gift of $10,000, which of course she immediately spent on building the house in Auburn, New York. But here's the second more important thing. It cost money to get those slaves out of the Deep South. They had to be fed. Sometimes people had to be paid off. Sometimes, for example, the one that didn't work out for her with her children, with her sister's children, there were bribes and there were payments associated with getting a person of eligible to be on the run. I don't mean to overstate this, but I think we have to acknowledge it. Harriet Tubman saw her financial resources, limited as they were, to be something to be used on behalf of others, primarily people in pursuit of freedom. So that when she died, she had spent everything she had ever had on that enterprise. Others, yes.
I don't have any statistics, but it seems like we're living at a time when what you just told us about what real Christianity is, isn't something that, well, it would be something that would transform each of us to the best version of ourselves in every way. But a lot of people are leaving churches and churches are failing. What are we missing? Are we missing something?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think you have to be very careful how you like. What? Maybe 3.5 weeks. You have to be very careful not to become, number one, judgmental. But number two, wrong. I am not prepared today to talk about what I think the church is missing. Because frankly, there are lots of places where some very wonderful things are happening. And I think we need to always keep that in focus. And here's something else we have to keep in focus. The church has always been a work in progress. I mean, I remember reading in a book somewhere that some guy once said to some of his closest followers, "Don't you guys get it?" I think the guy was Jesus. And I think his disciples were the fellows. They just, by the way, have some of you seen the ads on TV? He gets us. Wow. How important are they? How critical are they? How instructive are they? So that's the first thing I would say is that, you know, sure, there are some things that are really sad in the church's life today. But I think there are also some things that are good. Now, having said that, from my perspective, I think we have to get over this concept of labels. George H.W. Bush once said a phrase that I've used many times. Former President Bush said, "Labels are for cans. Tomato soup, vegetable soup, spaghetti, whatever." And when we start applying labels to people, I think, either shortchange them or ourselves. So I'd like to see the church get emancipated from these ridiculous labels like liberal, conservative, biblicist, critical analysis. And why don't we try to understand that when you look at the gospel, and that, by the way, when I talk about the gospel, I don't mean a book. I mean an idea. The fundamental idea of the gospel is liberation. And it's not only liberation relevant to the work of Harriet Tubman and the issues that face us in today's culture. It's what you're talking about. It's liberation within ourselves to free ourselves from the impediments that keep us from becoming the best version of ourselves. If you get a chance, I forget what channel that was on last night, babe, but there was a marvelous piece on Charles Stanley, the Baptist preacher out of Atlanta, Georgia, who's been on TV forever, just recently died last month. And I hope that if you can pick up on that, you discover that he says that for him, the proclamation, the preaching of the faith is to help people become the very best version of themselves they can be. So I'd like to see us, I'd like to see us talk more about the gospel in the sense of the word of, yeah, that means I should be involved in the work that emancipates, let's just use this as an illustration. I should be involved in the work that emancipates people of color. How about this? I should also be involved in the work that emancipates me from my biases, my fears, my prejudices, that allows me to become a better human being. If there's one thing I think we're missing in the church's proclamation today, for me, but then you got to realize I'm an old man who's had a stroke. So what do I know? I think we're truly missing the personal component of the gospel. And you know, I've been teaching now for about 35 or 40 years. And I am so indebted to the young men and women who have endured me, because they have helped me to understand how important it is to deal with ourselves. Young men and women that I see in colleges today, I am very encouraged. They do not have lots of the hang-ups, biases, angers, resentments, all kinds of good stuff that I think our generation does. And I think that we need to continue to work in that arena. And I guess I might as well go here since I've already dug my hole. I think that the church needs to realize that Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the great martyred Christian against Nazism, once said that the church has sold out to the culture. And I fear that that might be an accusation that fits, not only this time, but probably every generation. My denomination sold out in 1939, when we came together in the name of Jesus Christ to become the Methodist Church, bringing together three dissident groups. And this was the price we paid for that. When it came to organizing the denomination for structural purposes, we chose something called the jurisdictional system. We divided the country into six jurisdictions. They were geographic: northeast, southeast, north central, south central, northwest, southwest. Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. There was a seventh jurisdiction. It was known as the central jurisdiction. Now, was that geographic? I don't think so. You know what it was, don't you? Sure you do. It's racial. So if you were a white Methodist living in New York, you belonged to the northeastern jurisdiction. If you were a white Methodist in the South, you belonged to the southeastern jurisdiction. If you were a Black Methodist living in either of those, you belonged to the central jurisdiction. We sold out. And we're always in the position of needing to guard against that. So I worry about that. I worry about that with the church's life. But then maybe we shouldn't worry so much about it as we ought to do something about it. You know, we've been worrying about that for 2,000 years, and it still goes on. Other comments or questions or critiques? Anybody? Yes, please. So here's one here.
Hi. So this isn't really a question. This is more like an observation I had. You said Harriet Tubman passed away in 1913?
That's correct.
I didn't realize that until, I didn't learn that until you said it. I have, like, my great-grandparents, they were born around that time, and a lot of them from that generation of my family, they made it into their 90s, and I knew them growing up. So we like to speak of all this stuff, this history, as if it happened long, long ago, but in actuality, it's still in living memory for a lot of people. You know, the, like you said, that incident in the 30s when the Methodists came together and they segregated themselves. You know, there's people from the 30s still around who remember that. So I don't know. It's just, yeah.
It's a current issue. And when you talk about people still around, Barbara and I enrolled at Bethany College in 1957. That's not that long ago. Well, maybe it is. yeah, it is. It really is. But seriously, that year at Bethany College in West Virginia, which I might add is a Disciples of Christ college, that year they admitted their first African-American student. Think about that, 1957. That's pretty recent, really, and you know, as you would so capably acknowledge. I mean, there are people around who remember that. And then the second year we were there, they acknowledged, they admitted an African-American male, and he was a great fullback. So you're right. Many of these problems or issues have been with us yesterday. And they're not, and I think that there's several ways to look at that. One of them is to say, you know, we better stay on this. The other is not to get too hard on ourselves. You know, I think sometimes we can become masochists and beat up on our institutions, our lives, our moving forward. I'm a great believer that history is not linear. The old liberal movement back in the 20s proved that to be wrong. They said, we're getting better and better and better. And then what happened? World War I, and then that was followed by the Depression. Yeah, we're getting better, all right. I think we're much more in a cyclical concept of history. And if you subscribe to that understanding of history, you can realize that while we need to be doing some of these things, yes, no doubt about it, and they're recurring, nevertheless, we're not alone here. Yeah, I think I'm out of time. Thank you so much for coming today and for your questions. Next time, Corrie ten Boom.